energy and emissions model for cities that we've been working on for the for many years, but this particular version for the past year. And we're very excited to share this model with you here. I think it's very appropriate, and hopefully will help us figure out how to reduce emissions significantly into the future. So I just like to give you a quick overview. I work with a cooperative, a workers' cooperative based in Canada called Sustainability Solutions Group. We work on climate change mitigation and adaptation, urban planning, green buildings, and policy. And we've been around for 12 or 13 years and have offices across Canada as well as in Bristol and in New York. And for this project, we've also partnered with a modeling firm based out of Ottawa in Canada called What If. And they are modeling geeks. That's all they do. They build models of whole economies of countries or whole energy systems of countries. And I would say are one of the top modeling firms in that sort of sphere internationally. And they've built specific models for urban planning and energy previously as well. So we know right now that the emissions targets, the INDCs, that the national governments have put forward are not enough. And there's a significant gap between the targets that have been put forward and the policies that national governments have and what is required to reduce emissions below 2 degrees and 1.5 degrees, or 1.5 degrees, which is more or less the safe level of emissions. And that gap is a big problem. We don't really know what to do about that gap. How do we address it? And one of our proposals is that cities are going to be a key element in fulfilling that gap. And we've started to see recognition of the roles that cities can play, both through the UN climate change process, for example, the NASCA platform, and also through reports such as the latest IPCC report, which had a specific chapter on cities and land use. And we know that there's going to be a lot of growth in cities in the near and shorter term future as the world continues to urbanize. And that growth in that urbanization process represents an opportunity and a challenge, but we're looking at it as an opportunity. How can we ensure that those cities, that growth that happens in the future, is zero or low carbon? And that's really the challenge that we're seeking to address. We also know that cities are really interesting because everything comes together in cities. That's where a lot of so-called human activity occurs, and that activity uses energy, whether it's through moving around or building places to live in or so forth. So cities are really kind of a microcosm of energy consumption for the world. And that's why we're really fascinated with cities. They're something that's kind of tangible. You can get your mind around, well, this is how people live in a city, whereas that tangibility kind of disappears when you go up to the nation state level. But they're also incubators, so we're seeing a lot of the really interesting solutions, not only technological solutions, but also governance solutions that are being pioneered at the city scale. So you can kind of test things in a city and see if it works, and then if it works, you can roll it out to other cities and also to higher levels of government. So they're kind of a fun place to experiment and try new ideas. And this is a picture of near right in Jeremy's neighborhood, actually, of a district energy system that runs off heat from the sewer system. They're extracting the heat out of the sewer system. But we also know that the future is unknowable. And that is the definition of future, is you cannot know what's going to happen. But we do know that there are certain decisions that we make today that have an influence on the future, and that's what we're really interested in exploring, is those decisions which implicate our options or have a defining influence on what will happen in the future. And one of the best examples of that is the way in which we've designed cities, particularly in North America, for the car. And when you start designing a city for the private automobile, you enter into a cycle that basically self-perpetuates. All of a sudden, you end up with city planning that supports the car, and you end up with infrastructure that supports the car. And once you're in that cycle, it's very difficult to get out of it. And that cycle we've heard many different people describe this, it's called lock-in or path dependence. And once you've entered that cycle, it's hard to escape, and it costs a lot of money and a lot of effort and a lot of resources to escape that cycle. So that's kind of the cycle that we're really thinking about when trying to model the future, is how do we ensure that we don't get locked in to a cycle that limits or even impedes our options to reduce emissions. And just to highlight how that plays out, I love this picture of two cities of more or less the same population, Barcelona and Atlanta. And Atlanta was very much designed around the private automobile, whereas Barcelona wasn't. And the result is that the emissions in Atlanta are approximately six or seven times that of Barcelona. I mean, there's obviously other factors in their cultural and so forth, but you can see the geographic spread of Atlanta versus Barcelona. And that spread has all sorts of implications. So, for example, district energy is very difficult to do in Atlanta, whereas it just makes sense in Barcelona. Transit systems are very costly to undertake in Atlanta, whereas they just make sense in Barcelona. So that's an example of lock-in or path dependence. And that's what we really want to ensure that we're thinking about when we're designing cities for the future. And when you look at the process of managing energy through that lens, there's a framework that was developed by a researcher in British Columbia in Canada, Mark Jacquard, called community energy planning. And basically the logic is target first what lasts longest and then go down from there. So we know once you've got a land use pattern that's established, that tends to last 100 or more years, and it's very challenging to change. Whereas an air conditioning system in a building, those are switched out every 5 years. So don't worry so much about the air conditioning system, but make sure you get the land use patterns right. Because once you've made that investment in terms of money and concrete and people get used to it, it's very difficult to change. So we first sort of explored this idea more than 10 years ago when this little island, it's Salt Spring Island on the west coast of Canada, it's a sort of enclave of perhaps you could call them radicals or used to be, now it's become very gentrified. But they were interested in exploring what would happen if they changed their land use patterns, what kind of emissions they could save. And that was a very novel question at the time. No one had really thought about that. This was 10 or so years ago. And they issued a little request for proposals, very small little project, and we were really curious, so we responded to this, and we started trying to figure out different equations and so forth that we could evaluate the implications of changing land use and for greenhouse gas emissions. And we found that if they concentrated future development in what we called a villages scenario, they could reduce their emissions by 22% without really doing anything else, without changing the types of cars they had, without changing the types of buildings, because people would all of a sudden start to walk more, they'd cycle more, buildings would have shared walls, and they'd use less energy. So just by intervening at the land use level, we found we could reduce emissions by approximately 20%. And that was a really interesting finding, and then we started digging into that more and working with other municipalities on the same kind of question. And then we started to get a good understanding of where emissions come from in cities. So this was kind of a bubble diagram for another region on the west coast of Canada where we started exploring the different dimensions of emissions within an urban context. And then we were also lucky in that state or province in the west coast of Canada had inventories for 160 municipalities. So we were able to compare all sorts of variables for all of those municipalities and see how land use influenced the emissions and how income influenced the emissions and how behavior, age, all of those different kind of variables were influencing the emissions in these communities through simple correlation analysis, which has lots of limitations. And then we kept working in this field and have worked with dozens of cities now trying to understand that relationship and what actions are the most effective to take in terms of reducing emissions. And so then we were doing all of this in Excel, and I don't know how many people here have worked in Excel extensively. So you'll probably be somewhat sympathetic when you think about Excel with dozens of worksheets, all interrelated and formulas that bounce back and forth, and you try and change one variable here and all of a sudden everything changes way over there and you have no idea why, and you spend hours trying to figure out those connections, and it's kind of an endless game. And we quickly ran into that limit with building this sort of comprehensive model of emissions and energy at a city scale. And through a project with Anne, who's here, we were introduced to this modeling firm who basically had a whole f- it's essentially Excel for models. It's like a specially designed program in which you build very sophisticated models. I didn't even know such a program existed, but it's a whole platform in which you can construct a model. In the same way that you construct a Word document in Word, in this platform you actually build models. And so over breakfast one morning, we developed the conceptual framework for a new city-scale energy emissions and finance model, which we've spent the last year implementing. And so these guys had, the What If group had already developed very sophisticated energy models. So we were able to steal some pieces from their national energy model. For example, this is looking at all the primary sources of energy and how it's used, and then conversion losses and so forth. And we were able to sort of transpose some of those down to the city scale. And the other ingredient which made all this process, all this possible, was last year I was in Lima at the climate change meeting there, and the global protocol, GHG protocol for cities, was launched. And this was a joint venture between a number of different organizations who work with cities. And this was critical because up until now, or up until that launch, every city had been reporting on its energy and emissions in different ways. And so there was no comparability. It was all over the place. And this has now given provided a common common accounting framework for energy and emissions. And there's still lots of variation within that framework, but at least it's given us a common platform that we can then build a model around that will be the same for cities all around the world. And that, the combination of the much more sophisticated modeling platform and the accounting protocol, enables us to enables the model to work for large cities. So now, whereas previously when we were working kind of at the smaller 100,000 population scale, we would have quickly run into boundaries if we tried to tackle something like Paris. But now the model is capable of undertaking and assessing any scale of city. So this is City Insight is what we've called it. So one of the sort of primary levels of this model is that it's spatial. And this is a really important aspect and unusual aspect. And if you look at municipalities, cities, anywhere around the world, the first power and the most important power they have, I argue, is land use. They determine the land use. They determine what type of buildings are constructed, and they determine where roads are going to be. They use zoning to allocate different types of uses on the landscape. So we made sure that the model would be spatial. And in doing that, we're able to determine all sorts of different characteristics of how space is used into the future. It has also a very sophisticated transportation modeling element. So we can look at the implications of moving buildings around space in the future and how that influences mode split. So are people more likely to walk if you move buildings this way into the future, or if you move roads, how does that influence people's accessibility to transit and so forth? There's a very detailed level of accounting for buildings in the model. So there's 30-something different sort of archetypes of residential buildings and more than 70 different archetypes of commercial buildings. So this means that we can reflect the specific energy use of a wastewater treatment plant or a very small 10-story apartment building. So we can reflect all of those different types of buildings within the model. But not only that, we also account for all the different types of energy use. So whether it's plug loads or air conditioning or heating, all of those kind of variables are accounted for so that you could, for example, in a scenario, replace all of the oil furnaces with air-to-air heat pumps. And you could see what would happen in the city if you did that for the whole city. So there's that level of analysis, not only in terms of energy and emissions use, but also in terms of finances. There's also a very detailed waste model in there, which may be relevant to you, but it's basically includes a solid waste and wastewater analysis. So you can look at different ways of dealing with that waste and its implication for energy and emissions. And also using the waste in terms of a source of energy as well. And then, of course, there's the whole energy model, where you get the energy from, what kind of fuels are used, and how it's actually how it's consumed, or the demand for that energy. So that's also all accounted for within the model. And just to give you a little insight what the model looks like, it's a bit ugly. I mean, it's very elegant. This is under the hood. And so there's all these different dimensions, and they all feed into each other and relate to stocks and flows. And the stocks and flows are represented using different shapes. This is the district energy component of the model, but it's endless chunks of these kind of diagrams that have formulas all embedded within them. And that's pretty much as I can explain about these diagrams, but they're very exciting if you're into that sort of thing. So we were, because again, we were working with Anne on another project, so we had access to a lot of data for Moncton already in a system. And Moncton is a small city of about 70,000 people on the east coast of Canada, and it was a perfect city to kind of play with the data and test out the model. And so we were able to use that data to explore some of the implications or to develop a low carbon trajectory for the city. So this is Moncton. It's on a river. It's got a couple of neighboring municipalities, which are basically sort of consumer, or basically everyone who lives there works in the city of Moncton. It's divided by a river, a very tidal river. It's very exposed to sea level rise. So we built a scenario, or three scenarios that go out to 2050. One is kind of the reference or business as usual. What would happen if they didn't do anything else? One is an incremental scenario, sort of some additional measures, and one is a deep descent scenario where we tried to get an 80% reduction and we saw what that would take. And we basically adjusted all sorts of variables to achieve that deep descent scenario. For example, the electricity system in that province is very coal intensive. So we put all sorts of green energy into that electricity system. We moved various buildings around the land use. We increased the transit system. We put some local or decentralized solar capacity in place. Increased waste diversion to 100%. And we basically were able to allocate, this is an example of how you can reallocate dwellings over the landscape. So we had the business as usual projection for growth, which came from the planning department, and then we were able to concentrate that a bit more downtown to see how that would impact transportation patterns. We also changed the mix of dwellings. So it's a very suburban type of city, so we decided to concentrate a lot of the dwellings in apartments and row houses instead of single-family houses. Just keep going here. So this is an example of how we moved row houses from, there were no row houses in their original projection, and we put a bunch into the downtown to show what would happen. Similarly, we increased the number of apartment buildings. And because it's spatial, we actually know where those apartment buildings are going to go. And we know the implications of putting apartment buildings in a zone. Like, some zones are very industrial, so you might not put apartment buildings there. Whereas some zones are single-family house, so you have to create an infill policy to support that increased level of apartments. We can also add transit, so it could be bus system or a light rail system. So we can assign different frequencies of pickup, and that has implications for how often people will use that transit system. And in this is the deep descent scenario. We, through those various measures, we were significantly able to reduce the mode split of personal vehicles from nearly 90% down to just over 60%, or just under 60%. And that was fascinating. So we were able, people were all of a sudden walking more, cycling more, and taking transit more because of the way the land use was reconfigured. But it didn't result in a significant reduction of VKT. So this is all three scenarios for vehicle kilometers traveled. So driving was happening almost as much, even though we had a major drop in the mode split for vehicles. And it's because most of the trips that people shifted to walking and cycling are very short. So the long trips, people were still driving. So even though we got this huge drop in mode split, it didn't translate into significant reduction in people driving. We also know in space where people walk. So you can see that there's a much greater concentration of walking trips closer to the downtown. And we can influence that by where we put future commercial development. So we can create new nodes that have a lot of destinations, and that will make people who are further away from downtown accessible to those destinations, enable them to walk more. And that's more or less what's happening in these slides. And this is the vehicle mode split. So you can see as you get further away from the downtown, the people are more likely to drive. Whereas if you get closer downtown, the percentage of trips that are driving is much lower. So we're able to start to understand all of these patterns in a spatial sense, and then influence them in the way we lay out land use in the future. So I'm going to pass it over to Julia. So that's kind of the technical element of the model. We also wanted to make it much more accessible to not only planners, but also community members. So I'll let Julia talk about how we did that.
Can everyone hear me all right? Yeah? Okay. So, hi, I'm Julia Meyer McLeod, although I've been told by some of my colleagues here that I will now be jokingly referred to as Julia Meyer McDonald. And yeah, now I get the fun task of showing you around this model a little bit, some of the contents and features, as well as some of the things that we discovered when we were using the model with the city of Moncton. Right now, I just have some static images up, but we will have the model available for any of you who'd like to have a dig into it at the end of the presentation. And so start out a little bit just with the setup. You can see at the top here there's a menu bar where you can drop down and have a look at some other sort of factors or themes. Right now we have greenhouse gas emissions selected. And then below there you'll see a bunch of graphs and charts that break that down a little bit further and allow you to explore those particular themes a bit. So these are our three scenarios showing the total greenhouse gas emissions. The top one there is the business as usual. You got the red one below, the incremental, and then the deep descent is the one in orange at the bottom. And then we show the aggregate and sort of percent changes, projected changes as of 2050. And those are over 2011, the baseline year there. Oh no. Sorry, guys. Let me get back to the beginning. Just giving you a preview, you know, flash preview. Okay, so that's over 2011, the baseline year. And you can change that also over to business as usual case. And here we see basically we got about 70% reduction there in the deep descent scenario compared to that baseline year in 2011. All right, and so now we dig into this a little bit further, and we see emissions by sector. And the yellow one here is transportation. Then below that you have industrial, pink is commercial, and red is residential. And basically what you see here mainly in the deep descent scenario is that we have the most reductions happening in the commercial and residential sectors. But we want to know why this is. So jumping a bit further, we look at emissions by fuel type. And you can see there, the gray, we have imported electricity. So that just refers to the fact that the electricity in Moncton is generated outside of the city. And then we also have petroleum products as well as natural gas. And here we see that the major reduction happens in electricity. And the reason for that is, Ewell referred to before, is that we moved over in the deep descent scenario to a primarily renewables based energy from coal-based. So it just kind of shows you some of the things you can start to quickly uncover when you run through this model. And then also that can be seen spatially. So you have the map here both showing the business as usual case. On the left side is 2011 and on the right side is 2050. And you have emissions by zone. And then we dig into that a little bit further here, and we're showing only the commercial sectors. On the left-hand side, the business as usual, and on the right side, the deep descent. And you can see that there's a great deal of emissions reductions that are happening in the commercial sector. And that was shown again when we saw earlier on that the reductions in residential and commercial. So now we're looking at energy use by sector. And you can see, again, I'll remind you, the yellow is transportation, industrial below, then we have commercial and residential. And you see we have a reduction there in the deep descent in transportation. And the reason for that was that we had a switch over or an uptake of electric vehicles. And so the energy, the total energy use is reduced because of the efficiency of the electric vehicles. But when we look at fuel type and we look at the electricity use, we would have thought that that would have increased by a greater amount. It does increase a little bit, that gray block does increase a little bit. We would have expected it to be more. And we see the reason for that when we dig a little bit further and we look at energy use by zone from the business as usual to the deep descent in 2050. And we see that there is an increase in energy efficiency in the buildings. So it's another thing that we were able to uncover there. So another way you can explore the model is it shows you energy flow diagrams. And I'd like to point out on the left side, if you look at these two, the input side, the imported electricity versus petroleum, if we go from business or the baseline year and jump over in the deep descent, you see a great reduction there in the petroleum products use. So just jumping back and forth. And then the next thing we see on the opposite end, useful energy versus conversion losses. And jumping forward, those conversion losses are decreased significantly. So again, we're noticing that we're using less petroleum and becoming much more efficient with our energy usage. Finally, also from the economic standpoint, we get marginal abatement curves. And so what is shown here is on the x-axis, you have the emissions reductions. So the width of those blocks tell you the relative GHG emissions reductions that you achieve from these particular scenarios. And then on the y-axis there, you have the either the cost or the savings of different strategies that are implemented. So the far right block here, you can see what we'll compare just to this one right here. So the far right block represents capping the landfills, the landfill gas capture. And you can see there, it's about three times higher than this block here, which represents renewable energy. And so it costs about three times more. And yet with the renewable energy in this case, you have almost 10 times the amount of GHG reductions. So that kind of gives you one first way of exploring some potential strategies and what benefits you will get from them from a GHG standpoint. So another great feature of the model, and as most of the models that we've produced with SSG, is that it's open source. And so anybody can download it, use it for nonprofit purposes, and basically dig into the model themselves. They can change the components within it and view and change the assumptions, the underlying assumptions as well. So in the end, basically we have an urban decarbonization roadmap for cities. And below here you have a bunch of the use cases for it. So we have an evidence-based energy and emission, evidence-based energy and emissions targets, evaluating financial impacts of policies and actions, evaluating impacts of an urban or city plan. And basically we put this together, for us it's really powerful because we also work with communities doing community engagement. And so having a tool that is easily readable and accessible to either these community members or to city decision makers themselves is really exciting because it makes it possible for us to make informed decisions that can have the greatest impact and ultimately to create the cities that we want to create and hopefully the world that we want to create. So thank you. So we'll be taking some questions now, and afterwards we'll get some laptops out for those of you who'd like to have a dig at the model.
Hello. Sure. Ian Bruce, David Suzuki Foundation from Canada. I just wanted to ask one question just about the vehicle miles traveled, the findings in that. I guess specifically, was there an increase in the number of cars on the road? Like you said that a lot of people were shifting to more sustainable forms of transportation, yet you know the vehicle miles traveled weren't going down because of the shortness of the trips. But I just want to know overall how many vehicles, are there large amounts of vehicles being shifted to that? And did car sharing or anything like that play into sort of your assumptions?
Yeah, we didn't evaluate car sharing as a strategy, although we certainly could. And there were an additional, I think, 12,000 people added to the city between 2014 and 2050. Or possibly even more than that. So there is definitely cars added as a result of that increase in the population, but that wouldn't have influenced the mode split, but it would have influenced the VKT, or vehicle kilometers traveled. So, but the really interesting finding for us was that all of that effort to change the land use pattern influenced the percentage of trips, but really didn't translate in the way we thought it would into reductions in VKT. And that's really, I think, a city-by-city results, so it would vary significantly in other jurisdictions. But because Moncton's already so spread out that there's a lot of trips that are just going to be long no matter what you do. So that makes it a really interesting challenge. And transit also becomes much harder because of that dispersion of the residents, because if you can put transit all over the place, but the ridership's still going to be low because there's no density of people to pick up. You're going to have whatever, three people per stop or whatever. So it's a significant challenge, which is why we really emphasize the electrification of the vehicles in the end as a key strategy.
Hello, thanks very much. I'm Renske Schuipmaker from the International Energy Agency. And I'm wondering if it's possible for this model to calculate the amount of pollution coming from, for example, the transport sector, and if so, how this is calculated?
Sorry, pollution from transport?
Yeah.
Transport sector?
Yes.
Yeah, it has a whole very detailed accounting of emissions from all the different vehicle classes, as well as the transit system, and it also accounts for air pollution as well. So you can report on air pollution from different land use scenarios or different, it doesn't actually have to be land use scenarios, they can also be technology scenarios as well.
So it's calculated from a bottom-up perspective?
From the bottom-up, yeah. It can also be calibrated against actual, well, it usually is calibrated against historical or actual data if it's available. But we built it from the ground up so that we could really reflect the impact of changing the form of the city over time. So we wanted to be able to reflect the impact of shifting a city from a very dense city to a very spread out city, or from a very spread out city to a city with multiple nodes. We wanted to be able to explore those implications. So that's why we had to build it from the ground up.
And sorry, last question. Do you use local data for this? Or?
Yeah, so the way we've done it, and the way we will continue to do it, is we submit a data request to a city. And that data request includes all sorts of different elements, from GIS, which is a spatial data, to and usually there's inventories of buildings within that data. And then we also ask for data from utilities, so the people who provide energy and water to the city. So we have all different sorts of data that we ask, but of course we don't always get all of the data that we would like. So we also have a database of assumptions and other information that we can use to fill in holes.
Sounds very interesting. Thank you.
Yeah, and we're slowly building more and more data and more data sets that allow, each time we do it, it gives us a bit more sophistication as we understand everything there is to know about every city in the world.
Thank you.
Hi, my name is Kashobe. I'm an environmental policy graduate student at Bard College. I'm just wondering, in the models, do you include life cycle analysis of, for example, new developments and new additions to the transit network and also sort of switches to, I mean, electric vehicles, for example, because I don't know much about Moncton, but I'm assuming that, for example, in most of North America, majority of the electric power comes from coal and maybe natural gas, not necessarily renewables. So I'm just wondering, does that factor into the model's calculations on emission trends?
Certainly, we account for all of that. We don't account for embodied energy right now. So embodied energy is the energy, for example, in a road, there's roads, say, made of asphalt or concrete, and there's energy used to make that concrete or asphalt, and we don't account for that right now. And there are inventory approaches that some cities, for example, Seattle has used what's called a consumption-based inventory, which accounts for all of the energy associated with all the stuff that all of its citizens use. So the televisions they have and the computers they have and the houses that they live in and so forth. The disadvantage of that approach, I think that's a powerful approach in many ways, but cities don't have, and Seattle has struggled with this, is it's hard to influence people's behavior in terms of consumption from a city perspective. But a city can influence variables such as transportation and land use, and so that's why we've used that lens. But we certainly do account for the life cycle of electricity in terms of which fuels are used for generation.
What about like building materials, for example?
We don't account for energy associated with different building materials.
Okay. I mean, I think it would be good, but it would probably be more difficult to include all of this, especially if you're talking about like changing zoning policies with regard to, like, I don't know, like apartment buildings and multifamily houses.
Yeah, we have actually looked into that in a fair amount of detail, and there's a really amazing database produced by an institute called Athena that looks at the embodying energy of all of for every different kind of component of a building. But the complexity of modeling that at a city scale is very challenging. But it's definitely something we're tracking.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, I was just wondering, or team, you know, a lot of cities maybe are approaching their actions and their projects not in this integrated a way. So if you're talking to, you know, cities that don't have such a joined approach from what they're doing already, how do you get them on the journey of actually embarking on a project that goes to this degree of taking an inventory and modelling in order to actually target their efforts better? I guess that's the end game, is that you want, you know, cities to be investing in projects and actions that are going to have the most, make the most difference.
It's
yeah, I'd say like the use of this kind of tool is sort of that's really what we use, because sometimes cities come to us and they're, you know, because they have to, they're required to do an inventory. But then when we're able to show them some of the savings, for example, that they can get, and, you know, getting citizens engaged, then I think that's often the way that we get them to come around.
Yeah, I guess there's two other things I'd say in that. One is we've been focusing a lot more on co-benefits. So a really compelling argument that we've been using, and we built this into the newest model, is the jobs. So if you're going to take a city that you have right now, say it's 1 million people, and you're going to take that city, which produces a ton of greenhouse gas emissions, and make it a zero carbon city, that's going to take a lot of work and a lot of money. So you've got an economic development strategy right there. What better economic development strategy could you possibly have? So we can actually demonstrate how many jobs are required to take your city as it is now and transform it into a lower zero carbon city. And that is a pretty compelling argument for a lot of cities that are struggling to attract employment. Because all of a sudden they have, by 2050, 5,000 people working on retrofits, for example. Or they have 10,000 people working on decentralized energy installs. So they actually have a very compelling economic development pathway or trajectory for their city based on reducing emissions. And a lot of that work is created out of savings of money that they're already expending on energy, because a city like Moncton is spending, say, $300 million a year on energy. So it's a huge chunk of money which can be, right now it just flows out of the community, but it can be converted into a major resource to make all sorts of stuff happen in the city. So that's kind of a lens that, in terms of framing it to council and framing it to mayors and so forth, that works really well. The other element that we really struggled with and we think is most critical is land use. And land use right now is really driven by development pressures. Like developers will say, we want that piece of land and we want to put this on it because we know it's going to sell. And that whole process is designed to exclude external considerations like emissions or energy that result from that land use. And so we've been trying to really make a compelling story to embed consideration of energy and emissions and even just active transportation in land use decisions. Because right now land use decisions are made in a very isolated way that has all sorts of implications, but those implications are just ignored. So that's something that's been very hard to...
Just to follow up, do you have outputs as well around like health, like, you know, warmer homes and health outcomes or air pollution and other things like that?
So we've been working on another model. So this model is very focused on energy and emissions, but we've been working actually with Anne, who's here, on another model called Places and Spaces, which is a sustainable development model for cities. And that model is really designed to look at what happens if you take a city and you introduce a high-tech industry. What are the implications for health, for economy, for quality of life, all of those kind of dimensions that are perhaps a bit, some might argue, softer or less tangible or harder to measure. So that's, we're working on, and that's a much more challenging intellectual exercise as well as modeling exercise, but that's something we're also working on. And it's more of a research project right now. I guess we also have another health model as well, but... Yeah. But that's another story.
Next year. Next
year. Thanks very much, Ann Dale. Do you have any strategies for, as we all know, when you go into a city or in even smaller communities, big data gaps? Can the model bridge any of that in any different ways?
Jeremy knows over here knows the answers, but unfortunately he can't talk right now. one really neat strategy we've been using a lot is the whole idea of archetypes. And basically you take an abstraction of a chunk of landscape or a chunk of buildings, and you apply that, as we call it, an archetype to a particular landscape. And that represents, it has a whole bunch of characters associated. For example, you might have a sprawl-type archetype. And that has a bunch of single-family homes with lots of space in between them and wide roads and so forth. And you can apply a bunch of those archetypes to a landscape to represent what you know is sprawl from looking at Google Maps or whatever. So you can fill in holes using... That's one technique that we've used.
Well, as Yul mentioned earlier, I mean, it's something that we deal with in essentially every project that we go into. There's going to be data that they don't have. And I think Yul mentioned earlier about the more cities we've worked with, we're sort of developing a database of sort of standards, similar standards that we can use or assumptions. And also what's exciting, I think now, for example, one of the platforms we use for mapping is OpenStreetMaps. So there's a lot of open source data that is available that we can look to.
Thank you.
I'm just trying to pull up the visualization part of the model here.
Okay.
With the French keyboard.
Yeah.
With the French, extra challenge.
Hi.
Of the French keyboard.
Hi, I'm a student from Swarthmore College, and I was wondering about your case study. What are the next steps for Moncton, and what sort of collaboration have you been having for now?
Sorry. What your question was? What are the next steps from our case study with Moncton, as well as, I didn't catch that last piece.
What is the city going to do in regards to the data that you collected?
Okay. I think you'll convince answer to that.
Yeah, well, we're working still to finalize the scenarios with Moncton, but And it was very much kind of a pilot project. We're working with a couple other cities that won't be pilot projects and are actually building their whole strategy around deep emissions reduction. So one is Markham, which is a city of about 500,000 just north of Toronto, and its goal is to be net zero emissions by 2031 or 2040, I can't remember which. So we're actually building a whole strategy for them to achieve that goal. And it's kind of a brand new city. It's built up in the last 20 years, and they've got a significant district energy system, and they're very ambitious. So it's going to be really interesting to plot a real trajectory about how they can invest in a future that is net zero emissions. And they're quite determined to do that. We're also working with Waterloo Region, which is known as the home of BlackBerry, for anyone who had one of those old cell phone devices. Sorry. But that region also is trying to figure out how to get to. I don't know what degree their target will be ambitious, but similar kind of target. It's about 600,000 people, so they're also looking, and they've explicitly framed their effort around investment, the community investment strategy. So what kind of investments can they make to achieve that kind of target? So for them, it's a very real process, and they're putting money into it, and it's their future. So it's kind of exciting to see. For Moncton, Moncton's a bit of a different context politically, so we'll see. I'm not sure exactly what will happen there.
But I think, so my voice is terrible, which is why I haven't been speaking. But I think to answer your question a little more in more detail, the steps that we take after the modeling is to develop actions. So we have kind of a high level yet detailed overview of what could be in a city, and then we kind of choose, the city chooses what it feels comfortable with pursuing, and then once we have that choice made, we kind of, it's like backcasting. We say, well, here's where we want to be, so how do we get there from where we are now? And we take all of the actions, if it's increasing transit or building insulation or how we do land use in different regards, and we map it all out. And so it's, if we take this action incrementally by this amount over this many years, what's the piece of the pie that takes care of? And then we assign responsibility, funding, partners, all of those things, so that at the end of any project that we do, there's almost no more work to do. They just have to figure out who's, you know, their budget priorities and what they're going to spend on and who they're going to engage to do those actions.
Thank you. Yeah.
So this is the online visualization platform that we've been developing, and you can see it's got all sorts of different dimensions that you can explore for a city. It's not yet complete, but it's slowly going to be more and more comprehensive. And the idea is that you can basically, for a community engagement process, you can take out specific charts and put them into a more interactive web-based platform for a community engagement process, so people can really start to explore all of the different aspects of energy for their city.
What about monitoring? When you like propose an action, how do you keep track of the progress made and the actions that are taken?
That's a great question. In one jurisdiction, which we work in, British Columbia, they actually publish every 2 years, or theoretically at least, an updated inventory for each jurisdiction. So it's a built-in reporting system that I think should really be copied in every jurisdiction in the world. It's the best system, because every 2 years the city gets a report on its emissions, its energy, and that's how they're doing, and it's always done in a standardized systematic way. So unfortunately that isn't done in most jurisdictions yet, but in other cases cities are required to report on a certain level on their own without a standardized mechanism. But it really varies from jurisdiction to jurisdiction.
But I think that it's important, like when we do that detailed actions recommendation, we include metrics. So we develop indicators with the cities we work with. We include metrics, and kind of this is your baseline level for that metric. This is what you're looking for year over year. and this is how you should report on it. And we try to relate that metric and that monitoring with things they already do, if possible. So if they're monitoring something for their capital budget expenditures, for example, or something like that, we don't want to give them like more and more and more work to do, right? Because city staff already have more work than they can handle. So we need them to track it, but we also need to make it as easy as possible so that they'll do it. Yeah.
Of course, yeah. No, I was more thinking about something in the model, you know what I mean? Like a kind of module that allows the cities to see their, you know, the effectiveness of their actions. But yeah. Thanks.
Yeah, we actually, that's a really great idea. It'd be cool to have a whole sort of system where they can input year over year as they, and we could actually build that. That's a great part two. That's a great idea. So I think the other thing I would highlight is, because again, this is open source, it's not something I don't think most people could just pick up and design the model, as you could see from those model diagrams, which are a bit perhaps overwhelming, but we are hoping to do some sort of like online training courses or something that will enable people to use them, to be able to use it. So that's a way that we can hopefully enable more people to use it in more places.
Just wondering if you talk briefly about how you've validated it. Like, yeah, how do you demonstrate that it's at least pretty close?
Well, we don't validate. we
just trust us.
Well, Moncton has been a big process of validation. So because we build the model from the ground level up, but we also have utility data, we're able to compare the results of the modeled exercise against the actual utility data and see how well they work. So that's the kind of validation process that we go through. And we have different checks and balances in every kind of sector that we can look into to explore the relationship between what we're predicting and what has actually happened. Of course, that only applies to the present and past. It doesn't apply to the future. And there's no way to validate the future. It's that standard line from modeling. The only thing we know about the future is that the model is wrong. It does provide insights, but it is guaranteed to be wrong. We've worked, so in our older version of the model, we've worked with dozens of mainly smaller sized cities and towns often. But with this version of the model, it's only been applied to Moncton so far. So this is, you're seeing it's very, very early days. Great. So I think if there's no more questions, we're done. Thank you very much for coming.